Starting Right There, The Wellstone, a novel by Will McCarthy. Recording copyright 2002 by Will McCarthy. This novel, read to you by the MAPI41 speech synthesizer, may be distributed freely. The Wellstone, ISBN 0553584464, was published by Bantam Books in 2003, and is available in paperback form wherever fine books are sold. Chapter 4. The Wellwood Deception Revolution.
Wow, thick.
Was that a metaphor? Because tempting as the idea might seem, a bagel of teenage refugees from summer camp couldn't do much against a whole queendom, with its police and truant officers, its infinite supply of infinitely patient robots, and of course its billions of satisfied citizens in their tens of billions of instantiations. Even if the boys commandeered a fax machine and printed up an army of themselves, the constabulary would simply shut down the entire area, round the boys up, and reconverge their many copies back into single individuals. The odds were so hopeless and the threat of punishment so dire that as far as Conrad knew nobody had ever even tried it. "I thought we were just looking for girls," he said, "to no one in particular." And that was who replied. No one. As the buildings approached, it became clear that the river had a good bank and bad bank. One side facing the city and backing to the suburbs, while the other had a nice mountain view. But put it up against the bad neighborhood and so became bad by association. The most questionable of the buildings was an ancient two-story cafe whose shabby appearance was not an act, but the result of a natural wood facade that had stopped looking luxurious a few decades before Conrad was born. This, not surprisingly, was exactly where Vascal led them. The cafe had a scattering of plastic tables and benches and chairs in front and behind, occupied by perhaps a dozen people of varying ages. None of them looked especially old, but then again who did? Conrad guessed a minimum age of around 12, just old enough to be let out of the house, and a median in the low 20s, with the oldest men and women just edging into their age of deceit. 30 or 40 years old, when the fax filter stopped merely harassing the aging process, and began simply to arrest it, lock it up, lose the key. There wouldn't be many folks older than that, except maybe as part of the restaurant staff. This wasn't the kind of place you came to with your parents, it was the kind of place you came with your friends, to drink watered-down beer and coffee and feel independent. Not much draw for the older crowd. You could of course stay in the children's cities as long as you liked. Some people stayed on as teaching assistants or administrative assistants or whatever, and a few remained as passive consumers, either to make up for a childhood spent someplace less raw, or because they'd frozen somehow in the latter stages of larval development, unable to pupate, to grow wings and fly away. Calcutta, for example, was famous for its Peter Pan ghettos, but there were better places for people like that, where stronger intoxicants were available and everyone was above the age of consent. This place was what they called a kitty cafe, no identification required for admittance. Whatever bona fide grown-ups you found here were probably up to no good, which Conrad supposed was the whole point. The name of the establishment appeared to be 1551, although maybe that was its street address, or possibly even the year it was built. Here, a flock of teenage boys was apparently considered less alarming than it was downtown. Only a few people looked up at their arrival, and any surprise they showed probably had more to do with dorky camp uniforms than anything else. Vascal seemed to take this non-reaction personally. His easy stride broke into a trot, and he uttered a quiet, ululating sort of war cry and made an overhand, "follow me," gesture to the boys behind him. They were officially taking this place by storm. And yeah, that did get a bit more of a reaction. A young man who'd been leaning against the doorway now shrank away from it, not caring to test his luck. The place was a lot warmer inside than the cool breeze flowing down along the river. Poorly ventilated, Conrad thought, and with a wood face instead of a wellstone one, it couldn't pump the heat out electrically, either. Very rustic. Hell, it was almost like being back at the camp. The walls were an egalitarian mix of wood and plaster and brick, with wellstone surfaces only at the serving counters, of which there were several. A few animated posters hung on the walls, but there was also a lot of static graffiti done up in plain ink, and the reason for this was quickly apparent. Each table had a big feather pen stuck prominently into a built-in inkwell. You could even see a few kids in the act of scribbling out their pent-up wisdom. "They must wash these walls every week," he said to Feck. Feck just nodded vaguely, his eyes on everything but Conrad. A sign said, "Please seat yourself," but there was also a staircase leading upward. And although the place was crowded with plastic tables and chairs and the people sitting at them, Vascal still had his momentum. A few zigs and zags through the crowd, a couple of bump chairs, and he was on his way up, with Steve and Ho and Conrad right behind him, and all the other boys streaming after in a long line. People looked up at this. Yeah. Looked annoyed, maybe a little worried. The second floor was smaller, hotter, less crowded and less decorated. There was enough room for the boys to settle in at a corner clustered with round tables, but the doorway out to a balcony seemed much more inviting, and that was where they went. and if Bascom was looking for trouble, here was the perfect opportunity, because the balcony had seating for 20 or maybe 25 people, but was two-thirds full already, and the empty seats weren't in a block, but scattered all over. Bascom Edward de Taoji Lutwi was full of surprises, though. As the boys piled up behind him in the doorway, he could actually have cut a fairly menacing figure. But instead he just stood up straight, clapped his hands twice for attention, and called out, "Excuse me, I'm afraid you're all going to have to move inside. The balcony is reserved for a private party." The quality of his voice was something Conrad Rioli was going to have to study. Self-assured, vaguely apologetic, and entirely official. There was no question that you were going to comply, and if for some reason you didn't, well, there'd be all sorts of hassle for everyone involved. And in the end you'd still be vacating your chair, thank you very much. It took barely 30 seconds to clear the crowd, and settle in at all the good seats along the rail. The last to leave was a girl of about 19. And Bascom, still stationed by the exit, grabbed her elbow as she passed. She was wrapped in a loose-fitting dress of glossy black fabric. Her hair and eyelids and irises had been done up in a matching shade, while her lips and fingernails matched her shoes with a seething red-black glow, like bits of iron sitting at the bottom of a campfire. "You lovely thing," Bascom said, "can you answer me a question?" "Get processed," she replied calmly, jerking her arm away. Then she paused, taking a good look at his face, and made a visible effort to hide her surprise. "Oh, whatever. What do you need? Are you in a hurry?" She chewed her glowing lip for a moment, then stopped. "I'm here with friends. We had a good table, which you just took, so yeah, I need to get inside and find something before they come back. We don't get many nights out together," Bascom said. "I won't keep you, then." She half turned to go inside, then checked it and faced him. "Are you," it hung unspoken, "are you the Prince of Soul?" Bascom didn't answer. "Go on inside and get a seat for your friends. I'm sure that whatever transaction is keeping them from you must be very important, but when you're settled, I hope you'll come and see me." "Us, I had a question," a brown-smocked waitress materialized, looking annoyed. "Did you just kick everyone off this balcony?" For some reason, she directed the question at Steve Grush. "No," he replied, with his usual sullen brilliance. "We'll have 14 glasses of beer," Bascom said, jumping in. "And 14 cups of coffee, plus some pitchers of ice water. To eat, we'll take some sort of chips and dip thing. And a big plate of cheese and veggies." "Does it come with olives? I love olives." The waitress had a well-stone sketch plate in her hand, but didn't write anything on it or speak to it. She was under 30, or looked it, but her expression suggested she'd seen quite enough punk kids come swarming in here like they owned the place. "Who's paying?" she wanted to know. Bascom held up a thumb. "That would be me, up." She presented him with the sketch plate, skeptically. "Authorized up to 20,000, Bascom said to it, rolling his thumb across its surface in the accepted manner, rather than simply jamming it the way punk kids were supposed to. "Plus 100% tip," the slate chimed softly, acknowledging the transaction, and the young woman's features softened a little. Bascom's face and voice and thumbprint and DNA pattern all had to match against an account balance. He was good for the money. Still a punk kid, but apparently not a thief or mooch. That tip wasn't going to change her life or anything. All the necessities of life and most of its luxuries were free for the faxing, or at least had downloadable free knockoffs, and everything else had a free waiting list, except of course for freedom itself. So no matter how poor you were, you knew your turn would eventually come. Penthouse apartment, whatever, just live to be a million. But the tip was a nice gesture, traditional. Polite, and a big tip was nicer still. He didn't have to do that. "I'll see what we can do." "Thanks so much," Bascom agreed. The black-haired girl had slipped away during the exchange. Shrugging, Bascom sat down next to Conrad, but Conrad was worried and asked, "Can't they track you now?" "The police, your parents, spending money is always a giveaway." "Oh, probably. But the account has certain security features that will slow down a search."
"Oh.
That's good, I guess. Thinking ahead, such is my function." The very last rays of sunset were visible over the mountains, between gaps in the apartment buildings on the river's far bank. From what Conrad could see, the buildings themselves were in tasteful colors, not selling anything or trying to be anything in particular. These were the homes of ordinary queendom citizens, with fax gates inside, possibly right there in the apartments themselves. Here ended the terrarium extravagance of the children's city, and there began the staid suburbs of the queendom proper. The green mountain spire was dark most of the way up now, the sunlight glinting redly off the top 100 meters or so, and inching upward with near-visible speed. The cafe balcony itself hung over a precipitous 3-meter drop, with a small grassy bank beneath. And then the stony shallows of the Platte River, which wasn't nearly as majestic as Conrad would have imagined. It was maybe 20 meters across, and shallow enough to wade in. To the north and south there were little sets of rapids, where men and women in glowing green kayaks paddled down and, incredibly, back up again, where the grass ended. The river's banks were lined with a random jumble of stones, and sticking up here and there were the concrete stubs of what probably used to be bridges. Conrad couldn't imagine why they'd never been removed, although they did lend an honest and finished sense to the area, neither pristinely wild nor immaculately groomed. Just here. From an aesthetic standpoint, Peter Cole said self-importantly, this place is fucking rich. The juxtaposition of elements is not as random as it looks. Peter was big on aesthetics, which as far as Conrad could tell was a mathematical pursuit, having almost zero overlap with anything real, like architecture or matter programming, or even feng shui. The worst of it was, he couldn't tell if Peter was being agreeable or sarcastic, so he refrained from commenting. Everyone else was ignoring Peter anyway, so that was all right. It only took a minute for the waitress to return, first with their drinks, and then again with platters of nacho chips, smothered in melted cheese and surrounded by battlements of carrot and celery, zucchini and olive. Here you go, hon, she said, dropping off the final tray in front of Pascal and Steve and Ho and Conrad. If you need anything, my name is Bernice. Just rap on the wall, or the railing. My grandmother's name was Bernice, Pascal mused, when she was gone. Nice lady, Ho asked. Pascal shrugged. Never met her. She died, like, 200 years ago, in Catalonia. Mayor of a city, fucking historical figure, Jesus H. Bloodfuck, Ho cursed, in a show of solidarity. He was always saying things like that. Donkey fuck brain bonnet, and diarrhea blood angel, and Conrad's personal favorite, mother christing piece of dammit. Ho seemed to take some weird pleasure in mixing his cuss words up that way. Or maybe it was some subtle organic defect in his neural wiring, that the fax filters dismissed as a mere character flaw. In the queendom of soul, character flaws were considered your own damned responsibility. You had to identify them yourself and then formally authorize a medical doctor to repair them for you. Or better yet, you could treat it yourself through personal experience and growth. And either way, if there were side effects in your overall personality, well, those were your own problem as well. But Ho was only 16, so really it was his parents who should be worrying about these things. And Conrad supposed they had, in their own special way, by sending the boy off to summer camp, very therapeutic, oh yes. Nothing cut down on cuss words like having to shit in a goddamned outhouse. A sour mood threatened briefly to come on. But the watery beer was really good somehow, and the nachos were even better, and anyway Pascal seemed determined that all his men should be cheerful tonight. Who could argue with that? And then, before they'd even finished off their first glass, Pascal's black-haired girlfriend showed up again, pulling up a plastic chair and inserting herself between the prince and Conrad. Hi, she said, matter-of-factly. How much was unspoken in that one syllable? Hi, Prince. I know who you are, Prince, but I don't care. I'm here to check you out as one human being to another, Prince. Which was fine, sure, except that it was Pascal she'd sat down with, not some ordinary puke 2 years younger than her. And she hadn't brought her friends, either. Probably hadn't even told them, for fear of having to share. Hi, Pascal said back, in imitation of her tone. Hello, Conrad added, with no particular inflection, figuring he might as well at least try. The girl nodded, sparing him half a glance before focusing her attention on Pascal once again. She asked, with mock indifference, you wanted something? Pascal leaned back and smiled. Seeing you, my dear, I can think of a lot of things to want. But I doubt we have much time, so I'll get right to the point. I need access to a taboo fax machine. I'm carrying contraband. What's your name, by the way? Her eyes widened. I'm Shmari. You need a Xmari. Is that a nickname? Short for what, Christina Marie? Zyomirali Wing, she answered distractedly. You want what, now? A fax machine. A simple, ordinary fax machine that will copy Tifakalau. Forbidden objects and substances. My men are here on a mission, for which they have certain material requirements. Clothes, for one thing, he said, pinching his camp-friendly shirt for emphasis. And truly, that was one of the camp's worst indignities. Natural cloth. The shirts and culottes not only looked silly, they would not change their color or cut or permeability. They didn't regulate temperature or dissipate sweat. They didn't obey commands, or even hear them. They didn't do anything. And what else? The girl demanded, clearly concerned that this was a setup, that she was the focus of some sort of royal joke or sting operation. jewelry, Pascal said, with an inscrutable little smile.
That's all.
Her eyes flicked downward, then settled on the only jewelry Pascal was wearing. The well gold signet ring on the middle finger of his left hand.
Pretty, eh?
It's not an ordinary ring. Now there was an edge to Pascal's voice. Of course it's not an ordinary ring. I'm the prince of the fucking solar system.
What do I wear? Gold, tin, it's information. Darling, quadrillions of terabytes in quantum storage. It wants out, with a shiver of excitement and dread. Conrad realized that they weren't just playing at being bad here.
They were being bad, they were going to be bad. Pascal was really pissed off about something. Hell, they all were. As fugitives from adult supervision, they had a fucking point to make. This girl Shmari, hearing the tone of Pascal's voice, huffed once and then said, I know some people.
I can ask for you. It sounds pretty serious, though. It is.
Nobody said anything for a few seconds. Finally, the girl got up again. Before turning to go, she asked, am I going to get in trouble?
Yes, Pascal replied.
We all are. The question is whether anything useful is accomplished beforehand.
Great.
She disappeared. Doing as she was told, choosing to go along with Pascal and against her own better judgment.
So what's in the ring?
Steve Grush asked.
Garbage, Pascal said.
Garbage.
Garbage.
Reorganization of matter at the atomic level. Into garbage, you mean programmable matter, right? Conrad asked, because otherwise that made no sense at all.
Duh.
Any well-stone surface.
But that's everything, right?
Well, sort of. There were still an awful lot of natural materials around, especially in Denver. But Conrad remained confused, because wellstone was fundamentally a form of silicon, woven nanofiber, right? Quantum dots to confine electrons in atom-like structures. In raw form the stuff looked and felt like some heavy, impermeable, beetle shiny plastic, but by sending the right signals through it you could fill it with artificial pseudo-atoms of any type. Silicon and gold, silicon and sulfur, silicon and plaster of fucking Paris. Then there were the transuranic pseudo-atoms, and the asymmetric ones, and the ones which incorporated exotic particles. You could alter Wellstone's apparent composition in so many ways that even after 300 years, a kingdom full of pseudo-chemists and hypercomputer search algorithms had barely cataloged even the fundamentals. But pseudo-atoms weren't real, and silicon was. Pascal was looking smug.
It's garbage day in Denver, me boyos.
If we each have one of these, and we spread out, we can make a lot of frigging garbage. We can even threaten infrastructure, which after all is the thing that separates us from the animals. If our demands aren't met, they will at least be remembered.
Raw.
Steve said approvingly, and a number of the boys echoed him.
Where did this software come from?
Conrad couldn't help asking.
Wrote it myself.
I've been saving it for a special occasion. Conrad proceeded warily, not wanting to sound negative.
How does it work?
I archived a year's worth of patterns from the palace waste chutes, and fit them together with a tessellation tiler. Any surface is mapped with the best possible fit in stored garbage, and the boundaries between garbage objects are heated and acoustically shocked to cut them away from the parent body. Slap it on a wall, and you get a pile of steaming garbage, except that it wouldn't steam, Conrad said. It wouldn't stink. It might look like shit, or half-eaten food, or whatever. Probably even feel like it, but pseudo-atoms don't have a smell. They can't leak out into the air, like real atoms and molecules do.
Oh, Pascal said, suddenly uncertain.
It wasn't a look that fit his face. Still, that's pretty amazing that you thought of that. You've got power for the separated objects, right? They're photovoltaic enough to maintain their own memory and programming.
And composition?
I don't know.
Oh, Conrad said.
Probably not, then.
You'll just wind up with garbage-shaped chunks of nanofiber silicon.
It's probably dangerous, too. I mean, there's more wellstone in a building than just the facade.
Right, you'd better be real careful what you touch with that thing, or you're going to hurt somebody.
Who made you the voice of reason?
Koa asked, acidly.
Nobody.
Why don't you shut up, then?
Pussy. Conrad had no response to that.
He'd already blurted out the thing that needed blurting.
Getting any further on Ho's bad side was not a smart idea, and he could see that Pascal was brooding, too, looking around with dark, embarrassed anger. That anger could, Conrad knew, be directed at him at any moment. He considered apologizing, but didn't see how that would help. Better just to shut up and pretend he wasn't here. Are we still doing this?
Steve Grush wanted to know.
Yeah, Pascal said, waving a hand distractedly.
Let me think about it for a minute. Then he pinched his chin in a gesture so reminiscent of his father that for a moment Pascal might have been a younger image of the king himself. A little swarthier, perhaps, a bit more angular, Conrad felt a fresh burst of affection for this boy, this young man, this poet prince of all humanity. "I have to visit the Sawyer," Feck announced loudly, from the other end of the balcony. That was short for pissoir, and told everyone exactly, biologically, what he'd be doing when he got there. If he'd said toyer, or chatoir, that would convey a different intention. You always knew more about Feck than you wanted to. Still, it was funny. Feck was pretty funny sometimes, and suddenly there was a lot of laughter, and the conversation turned to other subjects. "Sorry," Conrad said quietly, seeing his Pascal opening as Feck shuffled past. "It's still a pretty raw idea." "Shut up," Pascal said vaguely, not looking at him. Taking the hint, Conrad finished his beer, then just as quietly finished his coffee. Both were making him thirstier, but he resisted the urge to chase them with a glass of water. In a few minutes he was going to have to visit the Sawyer himself. He supposed they all were. He toyed with his coffee mug instead, clinking it a few times on the glass tabletop, turning it over a few times in his hands. Good, old-fashioned stoneware, courtesy of the Friendly Products Corporation, whose swirling green logo was glazed into the underside. This didn't take any great scrutiny to discern. The same instantly recognizable design appeared on their camp-friendly t-shirts, and on thousands of child-oriented products printed daily by the fax machines of the world. Seeing it here, however, was admittedly somewhat surprising. What was child-oriented about a coffee mug? He fantasized briefly that this whole cafe, perhaps this whole ghetto, was just one more friendly park in a carefully supervised friendly park world. Oh, God, he was getting maudlin, as his Irish mother would say. It was exactly why she didn't allow him any alcohol, even weekend watered as this. If he drank any more, he'd become rash, and then where would Queendom civilization be? "Does anyone else want more beer?" he asked, looking around, but they were still ignoring him, which was probably good. He'd just order for himself, then, maybe even pay for the waitress instructions. He leaned over and rapped on the decks at the old railing. It rang solidly under his knuckles, though, more like plastic or soft stone than wood, because yeah, of course, it wasn't wood at all. Just a clever well-stone facsimile. Why would knocking on a wooden rail summon a waitress? Suddenly, his paranoid fantasy seemed less paranoid, less fantastic. If that rail wasn't full of microphones already, it easily could be on a moment's notice. If the constabulary had tracked the boys here, for example, or if the cafe staff had decided something suspicious was going on, hell, the building could even make that judgment itself. Most of the symptoms of human intelligence could be duplicated with a well-stone hypercomputer the size of a fingernail. Conrad's own house was always scolding him, checking up on him, ratting him out to his parents. The black-haired, fiery-lipped Shamari reappeared, inserting herself deftly between Conrad and Pascal once more. "I found someone who can help you, B.A.'s, several someones." Pascal looked up at her, and the confidence was back in his eyes. "Excellent, thank you. And will these someones require payment?" "I didn't ask, but I also didn't tell them who you were. When they see your face, they'll want to help. They've snuck out of the house, right? Hoping something interesting will happen. And what's more interesting than you, on a mysterious errand? I'm sure you realize, you're kind of a symbol around here. The prince who won't be king. Lord of the oppressed. Spokeschild for the permanent children. I can't imagine." Pascal flourished comically with his arms, but couldn't quite keep the bitterness out of his voice. "Take me to your underground, then. We'll see what mischief this town can endure. You need more people?" she asked. "I can find more people. Easily, Pascal," Conrad warned, raising his voice above the general hubbub. "We should get out of here. This place isn't as run down as it looks. This isn't wood, it's wellstone. It could be a—" the prince arched an eyebrow, and not in amusement. "There's business at hand, Conrad. Connections to be made, a whole underground to be mobilized. One way or another, garbage day is a party I intend to throw." Conrad became aware of some noise in the street, rising up like the soft clickety-click of a few dozen tap shoes. Like marching boots, approaching at a trot, like the platinum feet of robots, dancing fluidly along the street. "Bloodfuck!" Hoa called out, from his seat along the railing. "Constabulary coming, lots of them, got—" Pascal said, and his tone was of regret, not surprise. "All right, lads, hit the ground running, scatter for me, and do as much damage as possible. Brew me up a genuine riot." Conrad was surprised, and afraid, and maybe not entirely sorry they'd been caught. He looked Pascal in the eye, almost challengingly. "What are you going to do? What do you think?" The prince snapped, then walked to the railing and punched it with his signet ring, producing a kind of porcelain clink. At the point of impact, there was a momentary sparkle of blue-white light, fading quickly to darkness. Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. Conrad didn't so much as breathe. Half a second after impact, the change began. A sprouting and sprawling of shapes and colors. It shot along the balcony rail, down through its supports and onto the floor, onto the wall, up along the roof. The sound of it was like tearing paper, like crinkling foil. The building turned to garbage around them, and the narrow spaces between the garbage glowed, and sang, and cracked away. Conrad watched Hoa drop right through the floor, just moments before the whole structure gave way, and suddenly they were all falling, in a storm of hand-sized wildstone fragments, like shiny black bugs. The sound of the building's collapse was remarkably low, more felt than heard, weightless for so short a time that it barely registered. Conrad thudded onto the steep riverbank, his fall partly broken by the plasticky fragments raining around him. His momentum carried him downward, skidding, briefly glimpsing the lights of an upside-down suburb reflected in the blurry water, and then a load of crap fell on top of him, stunning, immobilizing, whooshing the air out of his lungs. He lay there for a few seconds, taking stock, trying to breathe, wondering if he were hurt or killed, if his parents would have to print a fresh copy of him from stored patterns. He'd died once before, in some kind of fence-climbing accident that had smashed his head when there were no other copies of him at large, lost damn near the entire month, and never did find out what happened. Finally, he had enough breath for a grunt of pain, and then a groan. Other groans rose up around him, and screams, and then suddenly the constabulary was there. All around, men and women in bright blue, and faceless robots in naked, mirror-bright imperium. Hands were grabbing him, lifting, digging him out. "Can you hear me?" a voice asked. "Are you hurt?" Coughing, he struggled to stand. "Ow! My tailbone, my back." "Medic." another voice called out. "Possible spinal. Recommend immediate fixation." The hands on his body were gentle but very firm. He looked around, trying to get his bearings. Trying, he realized, to recognize Bascal in the confusion of litter and bodies and flashing lights. Then the first voice, someone behind Conrad, was speaking again. "Son, until we figure out exactly what happened here, I'm afraid you're under arrest." "Yeah," Conrad said, slumping against the hands that gripped him.